School Cool.
Welcome to the Making Up School Cool podcast, the link between research, practice, and theory for those who are interested in the activities youth are involved with during non-school hours. The Making Up School Cool podcast is produced by Case for Kids, a division of Harris County Department of Education, and I'm your host, Mike Wilson. This is a time in our nation's history when it appears the country is divided based on ethnic group, urban versus rural, women's rights issues, should we wear a mask versus not wearing one, religious viewpoints, policing issues, historical facts and fictions, and any other social problem you can think of. This brings us to the topic of today's podcast, strategies for addressing sensitive issues in our lives and community regarding diversity. My guest for this episode of the Making Up School Cool podcast is Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., and he has been guiding individuals and groups in workshops that encourage participants to explore issues of diversity, privilege, oppression, and leadership across America. His trainings and conferences require participants to examine their own biases, behaviors, and belief systems. As a result, they're honored to take positive action against hatred, bigotry, and oppression. Dr. Moore worked with organizations, businesses, cities, institutions, and schools to tailor culturally competency training that have been described as high energy, motivating, challenging, and enlightening. Dr. Moore achieved success in academia, business, diversity, leadership, and community service. In 1996, he started America and More LLC to provide diversity and leadership training and workshops. Dr. Moore, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to be with us on the Making Up School Cool podcast. How are you doing today?
Oh, my life is busy, but overall, pandemic, the time we've been in quarantine has taught me that little things matter. And I am just really fortunate, blessed to have all the little things I need. So I can't complain. Brother Mike, thanks for having me.
I want to start our conversation with what seems to be an issue currently happening in our country. We live in a country of such extraordinary diversity, yet there appears to be a growing number of people who are searching for ways to recognize their own needs as well as the needs of others regarding social justice, equality, and a general better understanding of the world we live in. This is a daunting task, yet you decided to address these issues decades ago. What was your inspiration for starting America and More in the mid-1990s?
Yeah, I think I'm a school teacher, Mike. You know, I'm an educator, I'm a coach, basketball, football. You know, I think a big part of my wiring, my foundation, I mean, as early as I can remember, at least, you know, hanging out with my mom and watching the work she was doing as a nurse assistant. I mean, I always feel like I was wired with wanting to contribute something positive in reference to my work, in reference to who I was and what I would be about in the future. And I thought the path that I would be doing that is through education. So that's really how I got started. And so I went to a small college in Iowa, and I was from a, you know, pretty much all black town, small community in Florida. And it was when I got to Iowa that I was realizing that there were people living their lives in total segregation, total isolation. I knew some of that was happening in the South and reasons why, so to speak, in reference to some of the, you know, the historical dynamics, the political dynamics, so on and so forth. But when I got to the Midwest and to see this, not only this isolation, Mike, but also, I mean, we're talking about people who had zero experience. Even in, you know, the South Florida, we would have segregated communities, but we'd at least have some times that we'd be in interaction with each other. I mean, I got to the Midwest and was realizing, I mean, for some of the people that I went to college with, I played ball with, I was the first black guy they ever even touched. And so I think that it was a combination of my commitment to education and really uncovering through my undergrad and then my master's degree, some real opportunity to not only contribute to the educational field, but also to help people to get at what you just mentioned, this increasingly diverse world that we're living in, this increasingly diverse country that we're living in, but many people having zero experience, zero skills. And so I found my niche. I was blessed and fortunate to be able to find a kind of merging of both my coaching, my teaching, and my desire to give back. And that's what motivated me to start America and More and really start informing and coaching and doing presentations for teachers, for parents, for kids around the issue of diversity. And basically my motto is America's changing, the world is changing. The question is, are you changing? And what are the things that we need to do to keep building the kind of society, the kind of world, the kind of country that we've been striving to try to put in place since the beginning. So that's a lot to talk a little bit about how it got started, but that's it, Mike. That's how it all got started.
In regards to your workshops and training, your leadership style has been described as one based on the belief that people must work together as a team instead of a system based on power. Can you please explain how you developed this type of leadership style?
Yeah, I think a big part of that is my, you know, foundation, a Southern Baptist boy growing up in a kind of church community, but a community in general where, I mean, people literally relied on each other. I mean, when I walked to the rec center from my housing project, you know, there were like four houses along the way. If I misbehave in any way, Miss Russell, Miss Wilson, Miss Wiley, or Miss Harris would call my mama and let her know. I mean, it was just like a wire service on the way to the community center. I mean, that has always been a part of my wiring, a comprehensive community effort. And so I think part of that being wired in me really was a big part of what I wanted to do when it came to accomplishing any kind of goals I was in charge of in reference to as a leader, that I feel competent and confident that I can make decisions. I got the credentials, I got the publications, but really I feel like decisions, good decisions are made when people feel a part of that. And I think we like to call it the relationship model, or the components are understanding, respecting, connecting. I mean, I've, you know, kind of developed it and evolved it in several different ways, but the bottom line, the main foundation is community, relationships, is that when people work together to make sure that the kid gets to the rec center, that the kid gets to the rec center. And that's really the essence of my leadership style.
It's funny because the way you described your upbringing sounds very similar to the way I was raised. I can remember when my brother and I finished our schoolwork and we went outside to play. We would jump on our bikes, and no matter where we went, adults would always come out and ask how our mom was doing. Now that I'm an adult, I recognize that this line of questioning is based on people in my community saying, hey, we're watching you, so don't get in trouble, because the first thing that you do wrong, we're going to let your mom know. Now, let's shift gears a little bit and discuss a very controversial term, which is privilege. When we examine current topics of discussion today, privilege frequently comes up. However, you're a little bit ahead of the game because you discussed these issues over 6 years ago. Can you briefly tell us about the Privilege Institute, which you founded in 2014? What is its purpose and what's the intended outcomes?
Yeah, the Privilege Institute is our 501c3. That's really our umbrella organization. And our motto at the Privilege Institute is, if you have a lot, you should do a lot. One of our preeminent programs, our biggest program, in fact, is the White Privilege Conference. We do that annually. It normally attracts about 2,000 people, predating COVID. We're really taking a look at what conferencing may look at post-COVID. But the conference has been going on now over 20 years. And that was the main program that we were doing, I was doing for those 20 plus years. About 5-6 years ago, after partnering with some universities as a part of putting on the conference, we decided to form our own 501c3, the Privilege Institute. And again, our biggest program is the White Privilege Conference, but now we're taking our motto, if you have a lot, you should do a lot, to really turn to local community, regional community, state community, but even some national communities to really start to help people to understand everybody has privilege. Having privilege is not a bad thing, but if you understand it, power and privilege especially, you can do some good things with it. And what those good things are, how to partner with people and organizations to not just give them money, but to be in partnership with money. So that's one aspect of what we're doing. In addition to that, in our local community, we have a summer camp, a cell phone free summer camp that we started there, trying to, one of our biggest initiatives is also giving back positive young people to the community. So as a 501c3, we're focused on that, particularly as it relates to young people. In Wisconsin, where I'm located, we also wanna, you know, reach out to people nationally and internationally. One other program I'll mention before I stop talking about the Institute is our global travel program. I found and discovered that a lot of kids, especially where I come from, I mean, you can relate to this, Brother Wilson, you know, seems like we had similar kinds of upbringing. I mean, the only time I saw other countries was on TV, and many of those were cartoons. And so we're really trying to help young people, particularly BIPOC kids, especially Black kids, to really see the world. We believe if you see the world, you'll want to be the world. And so one of our other programs that we are excited about, and you know, as the pandemic unfolds and trying to work through some of the challenges around that, but once that's done, we're going to be rolling out a global travel initiative as well, that's giving many of these kids, like where we come from, an opportunity to be able to experience some global interactions, and therefore their minds can be thinking global and not just local, national, so to speak. So that's a little bit about the Institute and some of the things we're doing.
Within your Privilege Institute, you address what some people may view as a very controversial term, which is white privilege. How do you get people to discuss this issue without creating such a big uproar?
Yeah. And you know, we were talking quickly about the executive order, which has come out of the White House. And one thing I do agree with in reference to the executive order, we shouldn't be putting people in trainings that's, you know, demonizing them, degrading them, that's inspiring conflict, you know? I agree with that. And sometimes that's one of the misconceptions about white privilege and even the white privilege conference, but specifically this term. Again, as I mentioned earlier, everybody has privilege. White is just one form of privilege. Race is just one form. So the way that I typically inform people about white privilege is through ability privilege, or through class privilege, or through religious privilege, to really identify some things, some areas where people can see day to day, every day, that there are just some things we can participate in, those of us who have ability, whether it's you know, watching our TV and not having to worry about the closed caption on in order to understand what's going on, or you know, watching and hearing the language and being, you know, familiar with all the language that's been used in the program, or the fact that you can even see the TV. You know, those are real privileges that people, I think, can relate to. And that's some of the times, that's the way that we get people on board in talking about privilege. White privilege can be a really daunting and challenging topic, Brother Wilson. So for some people, it may not be good to start there. But the bottom line is, no matter where you start, at the White Privilege Conference, at the Privilege Institute, we believe everybody has privilege. It's not just white privilege. And we have to look at it comprehensively. And it's not about villainizing people. When we talk about white privilege, it's not to say white people bad. It's to say that that's a reality. And so if that's a reality and an experience that you're going through, then are there some ways you can do some good things with that reality? You can give back, you can contribute back. So the goal is to understand privilege in order to do good things with it, not to villainize. And so those are some of the things I use. Those are some of the ways that when I'm talking to people about white privilege, that I refer to in reference to defining it, giving examples about it, but most importantly, partnering it with beyond race.
Topics regarding discussing diversity, equity, and equality is a part of our national discourse. Yet, based on all the things schools need to do and the curriculum that they must follow, the educational system spends little to no time teaching about the influence of diversity. However, after-school programs and community organizations can create a setting similar to yours to discuss these issues. What are your recommendations for community centers, after-school programs, and other nonprofits to set a setting to discuss these issues?
I think that what I suggest to teachers is not thinking about this as extra credit. What are some of the things that you're already doing in your curriculum that you could partner the conversation of diversity and inclusion, that it shouldn't be an added mechanism, an added chore, an added kind of experience that you gotta go through. So that's number one. And I think for those after school kinds of programs, you know, I think particularly when you make the program about diversity, it can't just be about kids of color. Okay, I think that the one way that after school programs can have success around the diversity issue is making sure that when you talk about diversity, it's comprehensive, that you have language diversity, you have religious diversity, some of what we were mentioning about privilege, right? That it's a comprehensive approach. And when you have that kind of comprehensive approach, I mean, the research shows this. I mean, this is all developed, expanding, growing research that when you have a diverse group of kids working together, playing together, solving problems together, that the actual experience is better. And so I think that any diversity related kind of program, any program that is looking to have success should have diversity related initiatives as a part of that. And that should be its mission vision. And so diversity, I get frustrated because people always think about it as an add-on. And I want diversity to be like in a classroom, like calculus, like science. I mean, it's a part of the learning. And in the kind of after-school programs, I mean, that any field trip you take, any activity that you do, any food that you serve, any parents that are communicating, it's a part of their overall experience and not just about those kids. That when we have every kid involved, I think that that helps those kinds of programs to find, to have some success, because the research shows the more diversity, the better the experience.
This ends part one of my two-part interview with Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. Dr. Moore, thank you so much for being my guest on this week's Making After School Cool podcast. As always, I want to thank our listeners for joining us for this episode, where our topic focused on strategies for addressing sensitive issues in our lives and community. Please join us for future broadcasts as we continue to explore issues relevant to the out-of-school time field.